This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Michael Strasser. The People Speak normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. And the number is 1-888-429-5471. That is 1-888-429-5471. I will repeat that periodically through the show, either on the audio or the text chat in the room. This is an awesome show we have tonight. Our guest is Gloria La Riva, I apologize, who is a labor, community, and anti-war activist based in San Francisco, California. Born in Albuquerque, she attended Brandeis University, where she was active in affirmative action struggles, number of other things. She's been a key organizer in mass demonstrations and other groups opposing wars, occupation in Central America, Iraq, Palestine, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, and elsewhere. She's also worked on issues regarding Cuba's sovereignty. And her website is votepsl.org. She is a presidential candidate. So how are you doing, Gloria?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. And thanks for having me on the show.
I'm very honored that you're on here today. So tell us a little bit about the activism you've been involved with. And, you know, when did you start getting into this? I mean, how did this happen?
Well, I grew up in New Mexico, as you said. I was from Albuquerque, and I went to college in Boston at Brandeis University. I was a very good high school student. I had good grades, but no money. And to make a long story short, I found out when I went to college that the reason I was able to get a four-year scholarship was because students, Black and Latino students, in 4 years earlier, in 1968, when there was a huge wave of student strikes and militant actions across the country, including at Brandeis, for students demanding ethnic studies, affirmative action, financing for under disadvantaged students, that I got to go to school because these youth had taken over administration buildings at Brandeis, and I won the right to go to school. So I always felt from that moment that I had and I've always been a supporter of affirmative action. Then I organized a union drive at the age of 23 in Rochester, New York, in a small newspaper. Got fired for that, but then I got a union card and moved to San Francisco. I've been active for many years, since 81 when I moved there, in anti-war. First against Reaganism, we all remember that, the wars that he was carrying out by proxy in El Salvador, Nicaragua. And ever since then, we led the fight against the U.S. war in the Gulf, the Iraq war. And then for 12 years, we carried out a campaign to expose what the U.S. was doing in its crime of blockading Iraq for 12 years, where over 1.5 million people died from lack of medicine and what a civilian infrastructure needs for people to live. Then came the second war of 2003, and it's just been year after year, month after month, week after week of myself and many people in the movement and in my party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, fighting injustice. And you can fill in every other issue we've been involved in ever since. I'm part of a movement. I've never done anything by myself.
You know, part of me really wants to ask about this early on, because I heard you had made a trip to North Korea. Is that true?
Yes. I went to North Korea in 1989, which was a very, it was a huge turning point for the socialist countries in the world, because that was when Eastern Europe, you know, Germany, East Germany had fallen. It was no longer socialist when the wall came down. And the Eastern European countries from Romania to Bulgaria and all the others, Hungary, they were no longer socialist. It was a major counter-revolution. So then came soon the dismantling of the progressive internationalist view of the Soviet Union. So by 1989, North Korea, which is also officially the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, was suffering from the late 80s through the early 2000s from a severe hardship due to the fact that China and Soviet Union and then later Russia required hard currency for their trade. Before, in the old socialist camp, countries bartered with each other, they had more fair trade, and that was no longer the case by 1989. So I was invited to go to North Korea in 1989. I saw many wonders. What I saw was a people working collectively in the agriculture and areas, working very, very hard to survive this hardship. They call it the Arduous March. It's quite similar to what Cuba endured during the 90s and the 2000s because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, their main trading partner. They call it the special period in Cuba, but North Korea underwent the same. I just fell in love with the culture, and so I started learning Korean. I later traveled to South Korea in 2001 for documentation of the war crimes that the U.S. and the South Korean army carried out during the Korean War, where thousands and thousands of people were massacred during the war. In the South, in the North, 4 million people were killed by U.S. bombs from 1950 to 53. It's a long story about Korea, but I just returned to North Korea in October 2015. And by this time, I knew more Korean. I'm still studying Korean. And I found that in this trip, after surviving what was sadly famine because of the wiping out of their agriculture by very harmful storms and rain and floods in the 90s, that North Korea has come out of that crisis with a lot of development. If you go to Pyongyang, which is a major city, it's the main capital, it's the capital, main city, of over 2 million people, you see these huge skyscrapers and of apartment buildings. And all housing in North Korea is free. Nobody in the country pays rent. Their housing is completely free. Their education is completely free. And they're highly educated, very hardworking people. And that's something you never hear about in this country. What we see is the demonization of their leaders. But it's more than that. It's even like mocking and making fun of them to really get the U.S. people and people in the world to think of them extremely negatively. And for the U.S. to justify the division of the Korean Peninsula, which is one country but divided by U.S. occupation, and to get people to except the U.S. war games, they're not games, they're war practices that they carry out with South Korea against the North. And this last month has involved simulated bombing with nuclear bombs using nuclear-capable bombers. And that was why I was so privileged to go to North Korea in October.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to, you know, ask these things not to, you know, be mean about it or anything, but, you know, I'm sure a number of people are wondering this, and it's kind of to get to the bottom of the truth. You know, a number of things I see on YouTube and elsewhere, videos within North Korea look like people are living in pretty immense poverty outside of areas like Pyongyang. So hear stories about using Coke bottles and stuff for IV drips. I mean, what would you respond to that with?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't mind difficult questions. I don't mind any honest question. I think everything can always be done with respect, but I think it's important for people to be able to ask any question they wish for a dialogue and for information. I think that we have to look at the history of all of Korea, but the North included. And the history of Korea is that it was a colony, an enslaved colony of Japan from 1910 to 1945. The Koreans were prohibited from speaking their own language. They were forced to adopt Japanese names. It was very, very brutal rule. And when World War II ended and Japan was defeated, the North was liberated by guerrilla fighters like Kim Il-sung, who became later president, and the Soviet Union helped to liberate the North. The U.S. came into the South and never left. And then from 1950 to 1953, after many tens of thousands of people were murdered by the KCIA, the Korean CIA, the South Korean Army, and the U.S. Army, just wiped out the left in the South, which was fighting for unification of the country to end all occupation of the peninsula. The Soviet Union had left in 1948, came the U.S.-led United Nations war of 3 years, and the North was obliterated by bombing. That was 63 years ago that the war ended. That's a very short amount of time. And the whole country was wiped out in terms of infrastructure. And yet they rebuilt what they have today. I have video, and I'm about to post it publicly, of what video that I took. And there's very many positive videos that you can see of what they have created. But as I said, when the Soviet Union no longer was a Soviet Union and it became capitalist, the support that socialist countries enjoyed, the mutual cooperation economically, socially, politically, and militarily was no longer there. And in 1994 and 95, the North, which is 85% mountains, there's very little arable land in the North. And the sad thing about the division of the country is that the South has enormous amounts of agricultural land, while the North is industrial-based. The North has great natural resources. And the division makes it difficult. The North has amazing development when you consider that they have been blockaded by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. The U.S. has used food as a weapon against them whenever it's been hard for North Korea. They've had to maintain their defense, their military weaponry, because of U.S. war threats and the fact that they did lose 4 million people. The Britannica, the Encyclopedia Britannica, says that the casualties were 5 million. Nonetheless, they've come quite a long ways from that war that was only 60 years ago. We don't even know that kind of devastation in our country. And they did have famine in the 90s because of the floods that wiped out all their agriculture. But I will tell you this, in all honesty, I think that they've made great, great gains. They have a major increase in tourism, which they need. They need sources of income so they can sustain the population. For a country that doesn't charge for medicine, that doesn't charge for education, that is an important foundation, that nobody has to be denied medicine because of lack of money, or lack of education because of lack of money. It's a guaranteed right. You know, you can always find things of hardship, of shortages, of underdevelopment, no doubt. And I'm sure there are instances of it. But as I said, they are rebuilding many cultural centers, the schools, the urban centers, and even the rural towns. You won't hear in some of the media that you see that, for example, there was another flood very recently that wiped out a small farm village, and the government immediately built 1,500 beautiful homes for a rural area. And the priority of the country and the government is meeting the needs of the people. That doesn't mean that they don't have under development. But the problem is that our government is picturing them, portraying them, misrepresenting them, and distorting the news to try to claim that North Korea is a danger by developing, for example, nuclear weapons, while the United States is the greatest nuclear danger in the world with thousands of warheads and the only country not only to use a nuclear weapon against Japan, but to declare that it has the right to do a first strike even against countries that don't have a nuclear weapon. So when we see what the U.S. did to Iraq after disarming it after 12 years of these inspections for weapons of mass destruction, which was a myth, after disarming Iraq, they went and bombed the hell out of it and occupied it. They bombed Afghanistan. They forced Gaddafi and the government of Libya, after a severe sanctions, blockade, and then Gaddafi, you know, made major concessions, abandoned the idea of a nuclear weapons program, abandoned the idea of other defense systems, his country was then suddenly bombed by the U.S. and NATO. So North Korea has learned that lesson. And we could talk more about it, but maybe you want to talk about other things. I don't mind talking more about North Korea and the right of the people to ever prevent another war like what they already went through. It's not just the grandparents or the great-grandparents that suffered it and died. It's that those, the legacy of war for them has been carried generation to generation. And that's why you see them determined to defend their country and the things that they have gained. And I'm not someone who papers over or tries to portray things that they're not. I've been an activist for too long to have a Pollyannish attitude about anything. But I believe that's why more people should travel to the North. And it's actually not illegal for American citizens to travel to North Korea. There is no ban, unlike the travel ban to Cuba.
Okay. I mean, moving on to another point, I'd like to know your view. A lot of listeners are aware that there is a pretty strong stranglehold in America regarding Israeli interests, and I'd like to know your view on Israel-Palestine and what solution we should look for.
Well, that's certainly an issue that seems to have stumped all the candidates, where they always claim, not just the candidates, but politicians in the U.S. like to say that it's an unresolvable problem. I think it could be resolved very, very quickly if all funding, especially the military, but all military funding were eliminated to the Israeli government. It is a fascist government that has used the worst kind of weapons, from napalm to cluster bombs to poisonous tear gas against the Palestinian people, and starvation as well. The Palestinian people have a right to their homeland. We believe that the Palestinians, all the refugees and their descendants, have the right to return to their homeland. And instead what you see is, with the close to $4 billion that the U.S. gives them as a grant every year, that Israeli government is using it to build more settlements, to build homes on any pretext, and to steal the land. It's clear that as they go along, the Israeli society is becoming more and more extreme right-wing. It's a very worrisome situation for the Palestinians.
Right.
And so my organization, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the other groups I've been involved in, we've been very instrumental in helping lead protests. In fact, there was a great protest on March 20th, Sunday, in Washington, D.C., from the White House to the AIPAC conference, where Trump and Clinton spoke to say that they would be the tightest friends, that the U.S. would be the closest ally of Israel, and that's absolutely shameful.
Completely shameful. I think in the short term, you know, we should look to end the occupation of these areas, have a two-state solution. But in the long term, as far as that's concerned, do you think two-state is feasible with such a small territory it is? You know, maybe there should be one state where both parties are represented equally?
Well, that's something that the Israeli leaders certainly fear, of one person, one vote. We could say in one word, we could describe it in one word, and that's apartheid. An apartheid that was even more severe than South Africa's. Even according to South African anti-apartheid activists during that time. And the two-state, I say this, there already is a two-state. It was created by the division of Palestine into two states, supposed states, in 1947, which was a disaster for the Palestinian people. And from that moment, the Israelis, with the help of the British and then the U.S. and the French, the Israelis have, ever since that moment, with the 67 war, the war in 1973, and other conflicts, have created pretexts, have falsified history in order to justify taking more Palestinian land. Honestly, it's up to the Palestinian people to determine this, but they're so besieged, it's hard for them to be able to even honestly talk about two states. I don't think it's realistic. I don't think it's a viable solution in any way. I think the best thing is really for the U.S. to stop its support for the Israeli government. People, a lot of the media, which attacks people who support Palestine, they like to say, just like the Israelis and Clinton and all the other politicians, they like to say the Palestinians must recognize Israel. But the problem with that logic is that by recognizing Israel as a theocratic state that creates a non-citizenship for Palestinians, it means that the Palestinians would have to say, you're right, you have a right to conduct your country, that Palestinians can forever be treated as not a citizen, having no rights because we're not Israeli, because we're not Jewish. It's a Jewish theocratic state by the Israeli definition. And so it is a complete denial of the right of the Palestinians to exist. Even Bernie Sanders says, well, I absolutely support Israel's right to exist, but the Palestinians shouldn't be mistreated. But that's the same as saying that you support an apartheid system, which is what Israel is, but that you think there should be equal rights for Palestinians. That's an impossibility under the current system. And unfortunately, because the U.S. backs that system, and because the Democrat and Republican candidates insist that they will continue this policy and give Israel whatever they want in weaponry. And remember, in the last Gaza bombing, that genocidal attack, the Senate voted 100% to send emergency weaponry to keep the bombing going. And there is, I would like to recommend one of the very best books, a very excellent explanation of the history of the foundation of Israel and its project as an apartheid regime, with a lot of background and verification, is a book called Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire by Richard Becker. And he's a leader in the Answer Coalition. It's an excellent book, and it's available on palestinebook.org. I think that a lot of people want to know what's going on and a lot of the truth and the background to the struggle in Palestine is not known to most people. It's important to be able to read about it.
I want to move on to other points of your platform, like making a job a constitutional right. I mean, how is this feasible? I mean, how would you begin to even go about doing this? And the minimum wage being at $20 an hour, wouldn't it make, you know, a burger end up costing 10 bucks or something like that?
No, I think it would just give, I think it would just take away some of those profits of Burger King and McDonald's and all the other fast food places. It's unjustifiable for workers to make $9 like they do in New York City. Maybe they're making a tiny bit more with the move toward $15 over the next years. it's or in southern states or many places where they haven't changed to increase the minimum wage, $7.25, I think it is now federally. It's outrageous that a worker can stand there at the counter and provide all this food across the counter and take all the money in on behalf of McDonald's and make a starvation wage. They're starving. They can't even take their kids out to eat at McDonald's.
I mean, I completely agree.
The issue of a constitutional right.
I'm sorry, there's a delay here between us. And
yeah, and the only reason that. Okay. Should I start?
Yes, go ahead. I apologize. There's a delay between us. Yeah.
But I think your question is very good about how do you make a job a constitutional right? In reality, the Constitution, which the ruling class and all those in power, they look to that Constitution as the greatest document in history ever. And yet, constitutions have been passed in recent years, recent decades, like the Cuban Constitution or the Venezuelan, that guarantee the job, the right to a job, the right to an income, the right to health care. And we don't even have those. We only have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which means nothing unless you're rich. If you look at the needs of the people today in the United States, there would be a shortage of labor if we created the jobs that are needed. I think of all the people who need care for seniors, how many millions of older people who are retired, who have extremely limited income because nobody gives them a break when they retire and their pensions are, you know, going under. So many seniors need care, caregivers who can take care of them instead of family members, you know, struggling to make a living and then take care of their loved ones. There is a need for the whole infrastructure restructuring from the water systems. It's not just Flint. It's Cleveland. It's many, many cities. You see the articles now coming out about school districts saying, be careful of the water because we think we have lead. The highways, the bridges, there's so much. The utility systems. We see in California, PG&E never kept up their gas and supplies, so that you had this bombing in San Bruno where an explosion of an unkept pipeline and 8 people burned to death. And there is a great need for jobs, a need for even people to go abroad and help rebuild countries that were destroyed by U.S. bombs. There is a need for full employment, and there is a total possibility for full employment. How do we do that? We do that by dismantling the Pentagon. There's not a country that's threatening the United States. The U.S. threatens the world. And I dare say that so much of the destruction of the Middle East and the rise of the Islamic State, the rise of Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra and all the other terrorist organizations in the Middle East is a result of the U.S. 25-year war in destroying secular provided for the people that did not rule by fundamentalism. And instead what we have is a military that keeps justifying billions more year, new nuclear weapons programs, new aircraft carriers, all kinds of preparations for more war. We need to dismantle the Pentagon. And it seems like a faraway dream, but I think what we're experiencing in the United States and will in the coming months and years is going to be not only the great accumulation of wealth among the 1%, but also increasing poverty because of the military spending. And I say this, you can't have jobs at home while you have wars abroad.
Absolutely. The war budget absolutely takes vast majority of U.S. taxes. These can be allocated for a number of other things. I'd like to go ahead and go on a break. We're cutting this really close. Be back in approximately 4 minutes. I'm your host, Michael Strasser, and we'll be back with our guest, Gloria LaRiva, and audience questions after this message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hello, this is Michael Strasser again. You're listening to The People Speak Radio. We're back with our guest, Gloria LaRiva, tonight. And I was going to ask her about upcoming economic crisis that she was speaking with me about on the line while we were on break. So do you care to tell our audience a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I think there's a great deal of speculation going on in the tech world. We're already seeing the collapse of certain corporations which were becoming quite wealthy just based on investments by the rich who have so much money that they're trying to invest it in what they see as the new gold mine of investing in those so-called unicorn companies. But a number of them are already failing. In the larger sense, the banking industry, which is really what rules economically in this era, in the era that we are in, the banks really have control of industry, the industry that does exist. They make the economic decisions, and they have impoverished a great sector of the population. First, we saw the housing bubble that was growing and growing by their desire to have more and more profit, to maximize their profits. And so they gave out these loans. And yet when they were on the verge of failing, some of these bigger banks, the taxpayers were still paying for that bailout of the $700+ billion to save a banking industry that is the cause of that crisis that took place. And yet they didn't have to explain how they spent $1 of those hundreds of billions. They just thumbed their nose at the government and the American public at the same time that they foreclosed on hundreds of thousands of people who could not maintain the payments, the mortgages, the same people who the banks promised they would give them relief. And the banking practices that caused that crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009 have continued ever since. You can read in the financial pages the warnings of some economists that there has been no control on these banks. And so their criminality impoverishing people by foreclosing on their homes, making people homeless, keeping the profits, amassing more profits, and creating a coming crisis. They also are responsible for much of the drug narco-trafficking in this hemisphere, and that is by the direct laundering of money to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. It's not what I'm saying or the PSL saying. It's what banking experts and even those who are charged with verifying what is going on with the money deposits. You know that the federal government, everybody knows that if you deposit more than $10,000 in a day or at any time, that you raise a red flag. And yet these banks receive billions on a weekly, daily basis of drug money that comes from the cartels and the people that they know that they're doing this for. Wachovia Bank was fined recently, a few years ago, only 2% of the $378 billion that they laundered, which was documented. And that's only one example. Bank of America, Citibank, and others. And so they should be taken over. The PSL in our campaign program calls for the seizure of the banks on behalf of the people on a national basis, on a socialist basis, and to use all those resources instead to finance full free education for students. And people can go, that sounds ridiculous. What could be more ridiculous than using $800 billion for the banks that caused the crisis? But when they rule, they make the rules, and they're the ones who use the media to justify their existence and their crimes. So there is, as far as the new system and the idea that maybe we can keep parlaying that debt to the future generations and just make more money, print more money, the reality is this, that there are only two economic systems that exist in the world today. One is either private property, where individuals or corporations can own the means of production, as we socialists say, the means of production, the factories, the land, the mines, everything that creates wealth. They own it, and they make the decisions that affect millions, if not billions, of lives. We say this as socialists, that all production today in the world is on a social basis. Everything you consume, computers, books, food, clothing, your house, everything you use, your car, gasoline to fuel your car, everything you use is collectively owned, collectively produced by thousands of hands, whether it's the shirt, your cotton shirt, the cotton, everything, you know the whole process.
So you want labor to bring home
the fruit? So we say that we want labor, we want all the working class to own the wealth that they produce. That means a socialist system where instead of the wealth that we produce being owned by a handful and a smaller group of people, that it should be owned by society as a whole. And that way decisions are made democratically. Instead of making new cars every year that you have to buy because they tell you you have to have a fancy Lexus or whatever on television or the latest drug on TV. Those are the ads, you know, if you watch TV, that we produce what people need. And have a much more environmentally sustainable economy. Otherwise, we're destroying the earth with needless production solely for the means of profit, solely to make a profit. So you see, everything is wrapped in plastic because the plastics companies, which are then related, of course, to oil, because plastics come from oil, they have to keep producing to make their profit and the people be damned. Socialism is the only viable system for the world today. Capitalism had a role way back when, but today socialism is needed to save the planet, the environment, and the people, to provide full employment, to provide free health care, free education, housing for all. Because today in the United States, there are millions more units of housing than there are even people who are homeless. And we say everybody should be given a home. You know, if you look at the Cuban Revolution and how they created housing for all, how they solved the housing crisis, because they had homeless, they had people who lived in hovels and in huts. What they did was they declared everybody who occupied an apartment or a home, they declared them to be the owner of that home outright, and they banned landlordism. That's what we're for.
And I suppose you're also for abolishing charging interest on loans, because this is another non-labor form of income, right?
Oh, sure, especially when workers pay more in interest. And look at the credit card companies. I mean, they're worse than loan sharks. You know, I know I've had a credit card where you pay on time and then it becomes 25%. That's a crime. And I think that the credit card debt is so enormous. That's another bubble waiting to burst. It's also been a way in the last 20, 30 years with the proliferation of credit cards. Almost everybody can have one. And you remember even up to the 70s, you had to have a lot of money to have a credit card. It wasn't that easy. But what it's done is create massive indebtedness of people and the illusion that you can continue with a low wage and a very unequal situation as long as you have credit. But the credit bubble is also going to burst, the same way that the mortgage crisis burst, the housing crisis. So it's all a result of capitalist maximization of profit. There's no limits to what they can do. Private property rules, the Supreme Court rules on their behalf. And on the day-to-day level, people are suffering. You know, I live in San Francisco, and the average rent there is between $3,800 and $4,000 now for a one-bedroom. And we're not just talking about the new condominiums that they're building. I live right in the Mission, the famous Mission Latino District, you know, very beautiful multinational neighborhood, very working class. It was always affordable. But now the rich, including Mark Zuckerberg, who bought a house right in the middle of the Mission, the rich have come flooding into the city, buying up every square inch, evicting thousands of people. And in my apartment building, where I pay $6.91 a month for my rent, because of rent control, right next door, an apartment that's been vacated is over $3,000 a month, 400 square feet. So working class people can't live there. It's a big crisis. And then you see the streets filling with homeless people living in tents or living under a cardboard box. You see this every day. And that's across the country. How can we justify this in the richest country in the world? And nobody can tell us it's because people are lazy. You see poor people working, you know, the farm workers. They work night and day providing food. And they're poor. And they're threatened with deportation. You see hotel workers, maids, people working in restaurants, teachers. It's not just a matter of the income, although certainly the minimum wage has to be increased greatly, and now, not this 7-8 years till you get $15 an hour, but also the cost of living. There have to be limits. We believe that it's important to fight for reforms under capitalism. We need to fight today to have health care for all, because it's possible even under capitalism. But ultimately, it requires a new system, the radical reorganization of all society on the basis of providing every human being the right, the real right to life, the real right to life. And that is the right to live with a decent income, job, schooling, peace, social peace, the freedom from racial abuse and police brutality, equality for women, the right of women to full health care, including reproductive rights, the right to abortion, the right to contraceptives, not like this ridiculous Hobby Lobby decision of the Supreme Court, taking away women's rights. We have a huge challenge before us. But I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign and the millions of people who've been determinedly fighting for his candidacy is a real, not just symbol, it just shows us how the people are really fed up and they want economic and social justice. And I think it's very heartening to see that movement that's developing.
So I'm going to have to ask this question. Someone in text asked it, so don't hurt me. Anyway, why are you running? You know you can't win.
Well, if I didn't get asked it, I would wonder. We are running because the ideas I'm talking about are not known by a lot of people. The reality of how the system runs, the injustice of it, the crime of capitalism, you know, certain things can pop out to people. People, you know, by the vast majority were angry by the bank bailout, but they didn't know how it was all connected. And they didn't know about our historical struggle in the United States, how workers won unemployment, insurance, Social Security, the right to a union, all the rights that people fought for by the millions, the working class, the ending of Jim Crow in the South, the civil rights legislation. This didn't come from the generosity of presidents or congresspeople. It came from the struggle. And so our election campaign is a propaganda and mobilizing campaign. We are not fools enough to think that we have any chance in a system, electoral system, that's based on creating the illusion that people have a say in their government. We really don't. But we're running as a socialist to spread the ideas of socialism, to encourage people to become involved in their movements, in their community, to fight for justice, and to expose a lot of what we see as the crimes of the government. And our proposals for socialism, but also our 10-point program of the immediate needs that people need today, the needs of healthcare, the needs of immigrants to full rights. They live, they work, they contribute, they are part of our society, and they should have equal rights, including the right to vote. All these things, that hundreds of thousands of prisoners must be freed immediately for the unjust mass incarceration that was created by the Clinton administration. And part of our campaign is also exposing what Hillary Clinton did in backing all of those very reactionary programs that Bill Clinton backed and signed into law. The mass incarceration that he created, the omnibus bill during his administration, or the effective death penalty and anti-terrorism law that wiped out habeas corpus for prisoners in the United States. And Clinton, now Hillary Clinton says, well, we regret it, but why don't you reverse that? Why don't you provide for clemency for all the people who were imprisoned falsely, who were given extensive unjust sentences, who need to be freed so they can be a productive member of society? Why don't you propose reparations and job creation and a means of social reintegration for the people who are in prison? This is why we're running, and I'm very proud of our campaign. I'm proud of our members and our volunteers who are working very, very hard, who will be working to get us on the ballot in a number of states. We're going to be working from California to Vermont, from east to west, north to south, to get on a number of ballots, although it's a huge, huge challenge for a working class organization like ours.
I don't think a lot of people understand that a number of the things we have today, minimum wage as piss poor as it is, and a 40-hour work week, they don't understand that this didn't fall out of the sky. This wasn't something that just was handed over by the fat cats. It happened through working class struggle and other things like your campaign is doing.
Oh, yes. The women's right to vote. How many years did women fight for that? The end of slavery. Everything. And, you know, there's that great book, The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N. That is a magnificent book. How many students in college have been able to read that and have their eyes open about the great, proud history of the working class in the United States? You could talk forever about that. And yet it's hidden from us. And we're made to feel that the only thing you can do in politics is register to vote if you have that right and pay attention to these outrageous, disgusting debates that we've been abusedly subjected to. I can't believe that the media really considers that it's okay to give free media coverage to Trump talking about building walls and expelling all Mexicans, and then denying Muslim people the right to exist in this country. And these fascistic ideas that he has. You know, I heard on the radio today a commentator say, well, of course the media, of course he's creating news. Of course we should cover Trump. Why shouldn't we give him equal coverage? But they haven't given him equal coverage. The statistics show that he has been given many times more free media coverage than any other candidate. He has gotten a week ago, $2 billion worth of what the media calls earned media, in quotes, earned, meaning he made these outlandish statements that then creates a base among his supporters to make those same demands, fascistic demands, racist demands that are encouraging fascist groups like the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis and other groups like that to then have rallies and threaten people in their own community, like happened in Southern California. This is the danger of the Trump phenomenon. And yet the media is largely responsible, people like CNN and those other networks who have given him just, he gets as much as he wants. And he brags that he didn't have to use hardly any of his money, his billions, to promote his own campaign. So this is why we have to run. If we didn't run, we could just be, you know, shouting against a wall and saying how unjust it is without providing our own alternative and our own program and answer to the crisis that people face. I believe people want to hear more of an alternative than the elections. We see the lowest turnout year after year. There is no president that's been elected by any majority in this country for many years. And that's partly because of the disenfranchisement by the lack of any kind of confidence in elections. But in addition, too many people have surrendered to the idea that, well, we just have to struggle and survive and hope for the best, maybe hope for a lottery, hope for something to come our way, hope for something to change. And what we say is, we got to get involved. We have to fight back. We have to organize and demand change now, and real change. But you have to tackle the international situation and clarify that the people of the world are not our enemy, that we have created enormous crisis in the world, the death of millions by U.S. policy, whether it's Central America or the Middle East or elsewhere, Asia, Vietnam, millions of people have died by U.S. war, and tens of thousands of soldiers and hundreds of thousands of vets who suffer such grievous wounded injuries, mental and physical, and barely getting any assistance, barely getting any kind of care. This country and the people of this country are suffering and don't even know that in Europe, in many countries, people have health care and they have education. We're not even up to the standards of other capitalist countries. We may have 500 internet channels, but we don't have a lot of information about ourselves.
So, you know, really briefly, because we're going to have to close out really soon, what do we do to defend our unions?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because I am a union official elected. And I work in the Bay Area as a union activist, but my job, I'm a union activist. And I was 23 years old when I said I organized a union, and I got fired for that. So I know very, very much personally, and being involved in the support for the Fight for 15, that the workers need unions. And the biggest problem is that the law and NLRB decisions, government decisions, have so stacked the deck against us that a corporation can violate the law and fire you and fire hundreds or dozens of workers in a union drive, even if they've done it blatantly, and it can take years to win that job back if they do. In the meantime, the union drive can be busted. So I was involved in 2008 when Obama first ran, when the union, the AFL-CIO, and the Change to Win labor movement both worked together to gather more than 2 million signatures of workers, union workers, demanding the Employee Free Choice Act. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but if it had passed, and Obama promised that he would sign it into law, but he backed out of it right after he became elected, right before his inauguration, he made an excuse for why it was no longer necessary. All the Democrats promised that they would support it. The Employee Free Choice Act would have radicalized and brought back the right, the real right to organize, and would have made it possible for workers in across the industries to be able to sign 50% plus one of their workers and get an immediate recognition of the union. And then even a mediated contract, if the company refused, I think after about 180 days or 120 days, it would have greatly sped up the right to a union and helped made...
Hey, Gloria, yes. I hate to cut you out, but our time is up. I really appreciate you coming by. Your website is votepsl.org. You've been listening to the People Speak radio show with your host, Michael Strasser. I'd like to thank our guest, Gloria LaRiva, very much for coming. Remind you to visit her website, votepsl.org. That's votepsl.org. Thank you all for listening and participating. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.